And now we come to the 20 most commonly asked questions from my own experience. Question 1. I find it's almost impossible for me to change my habits. Is this realistic? Am I unique? My response, you are not alone. Let me explain why. Perhaps you remember or have seen in a more recent video or movie the film clips showing the lunar voyage of Apollo 11. Those of us who witnessed it were absolutely transfixed. We could hardly believe our eyes when we saw men walking on the moon. Where do you think the most power and energy was expended on that journey into space? Do you think it was spent in going 250,000 miles to the moon and returning to Earth, orbiting the moon, separating and redocking the lunar and command modules, lifting off the moon? No, not any of these. Not even in all of these together. It was lifting off from Earth. More energy was spent in the first few minutes of liftoff from Earth, in the first few miles of travel, than was used in 500,000 miles for several days. The gravity pull of those first few miles was enormous. It took an internal thrust greater than both the pull of gravity and atmospheric resistance to finally break out into orbit. But once they did break out, it took almost no power to do all those other things. In fact, when one of the astronauts was asked how much power was expended when the lunar module separated from the command module to go down and survey the moon, he answered, less than the breath of a baby. This lunar voyage provides a powerful metaphor for describing what it takes to break out of old habits and create new ones. The gravity force of Earth could be compared to deeply embedded habits, tendencies programmed by genetics, environment, parents, and other significant figures. The weight of the Earth's atmosphere could be compared to the wider societal and organizational cultures that we are part of. These are two powerful forces, and you must have an internal will that is stronger than both of these forces in order to make that liftoff happen. But once it does happen, you will be amazed at the freedom it gives you. During liftoff, astronauts have very little freedom or power. All they can do is carry out the program. But as soon as they pull away from the gravity of Earth and the atmosphere surrounding it, they experience an unbelievable surge of freedom. And then they have many, many options and alternatives. If you will simply start down the pathway of finding your voice and inspiring others to find theirs and stick with it, you will develop the power of this new habit to grow and change in today's world of tremendous challenge, complexity, and unbelievable opportunity. A second question. In one sense, I'm very excited and intrigued by what you're teaching. But in another sense, I question whether I can really do it. My answer, that is very honest. But I suggest you ask two other questions first before attempting to deal with the competency question. The first one is, should I do it? That is a value question. The second one is, do I want to do it? That is a motivation question and deals with your unique voice and passion. If you can answer yes to these two questions, then you can look at the question you just asked, can I do it? Because that is a competency question, and that deals with getting the proper training and education. Do not confuse these three questions. Don't try to answer a value question with a training answer, or a motivation question with a value answer, or a competency question with a motivation answer. Think clearly and carefully about the three questions. Can I do it? Do I want to do it? Should I do it? Keep them separate so that you can identify the best starting point. Third question, why is leadership such a hot topic today? My answer, the new economy is based primarily on knowledge work. That means that wealth has migrated from money and things to people, both intellectual and social capital. In fact, our greatest financial investment is in knowledge workers. Knowledge work has gravitated from arithmetic to both exponential and geometric contribution potential. And this kind of intellectual and social capital is the key to leveraging or optimizing all other investments. Furthermore, the industrial age management control style and people as expense systems are becoming increasingly obsolete and/or dysfunctional because of the competitive forces of the marketplace. There is also a growing awareness that the human dimension, particularly the trust level, is the root source of all problems. The soft stuff is the hard stuff, and everyone is coming to know it. That is why leadership is the highest of all arts. It is the enabling art. Fourth question. This all seems so idealistic and moralistic to me. With conditions the way they are, I don't know if any of this is really possible. My response, the deeper question you need to ask is there a space between stimulus and response? In other words, do we really, truly have the power of choice, regardless of circumstances? If you can honestly say yes to that question, you will come to see that idealism is realism. You can't see electronic marvels of today, yet you rely upon them all the time and know that they are real. Before they were discovered or invented, they were not real, they were only idealistic. When you say that these things are too moralistic, this implies right and wrong. In your heart of hearts, you know that there is a difference between right and wrong, and if you choose the right, different consequences follow than if you choose the wrong. That's why these ideas are idealistic and moralistic, both of which are very realistic. Fifth question. You say that cultural moral authority is the most advanced form of moral authority. What do you mean? Answer. Take, for example, the Declaration of Independence of the United States. The sentiments in that document represent visionary moral authority. The Constitution attempted to institutionalize the values that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Constitution was in alignment with the vision and value system of the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration said all men, yet women didn't have the right to vote for decades, and many of the founders were slaveholders, and the Emancipation Proclamation did not pass for over 80 years. And still today, there are profound pockets of racial prejudice. Cultural moral authority always develops slower than institutionalized or visionary moral authority. But ultimately, it is the key to developing a harmonious society. The key lies not in government, which represents force or law, nor in private individuals or private business organizations, which represents freedom. It lies within individuals and groups adopting common meanings and values that are truly connected to their hearts and minds. This level of volunteerism creates a civil society, which is the higher third alternative between law and freedom. It represents true responsibility. This is the underlying assumption behind the thinking and writing of Adam Smith, author of The Wealth of Nations. Long before he wrote this classic, he wrote a book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments. This work, which was foundational to his later works, including The Wealth of Nations, was based on a very simple idea, that intentional virtue and goodwill are the foundation of both an economic system of free enterprise and a political system of a representative democracy. He acknowledged that if individual virtue deteriorated, neither the free market nor a democracy would ultimately survive. Sixth question. You say that one of the basic problems is that we are using the industrial model in a knowledge worker age. But aren't we still an industrialized nation? Everywhere we look, there is industry. Answer. That's true. But the nature of the value-added work done in these various industries is more and more being done by knowledge workers, not manual workers. So we are not talking about doing away with industry at all. We are talking about using a different leadership paradigm inside those industries. In fact, This paradigm can go back to the agrarian or farming era. Outside cities, farms are everywhere. They add increasing value through the strengths of the industrial and information ages. So we are talking more about a mental framework than a physical environment. Seventh question. How do authoritarian cultures create codependency? My answer, think about it. If you have an authoritarian leader who controls, what do followers do? Most passively obey. They wait until told and then do what they're told. This behavior confirms the perception of the authoritarian leader to continue to command and control, which in turn justifies the passivity of the followers. In other words, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. All of this disempowers people's capacities and intelligences. It underutilizes them. It turns people into things to be managed or controlled. The cycle of codependency eventually nurtures a politicized kiss-up culture, where right is defined by compliance and by loyalty, and where wrong lies in getting caught. This dynamic also spawns dysfunctional agreement, where people say yes when they really mean no. It eliminates healthy conflict and spawns resentment, anger, malicious obedience, low trust, low quality, and low performance. Such unexpressed feelings never really die. They're buried alive and come forth later in uglier ways. The authoritarian then carries the responsibility for results and focuses upon efficiency. That is, methods, process, and steps, so that rules begin to take the place of human judgment. All this reinforces leadership as a position, not a choice. It becomes part of the cultural DNA. Little by little, you see the truth of Lord Acton's statement that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Everyone then becomes self-serving and subordinates their integrity to pleasing the boss. Thus, loyalty, in that sense, is put higher than integrity. The problem is, in the new economy, institutionalized codependent cultures can only survive through market ignorance, through artificial subsidizing, terror, or by heavy tradition that is sustainable only because the competition is also codependent. This whole cycle can be broken by one person who sees leadership as a choice, who begins to trim tab a larger circle of influence, and who relies upon the pragmatics of a competitive marketplace to break the self-fulfilling downward spiral. This leadership represents moral authority, which comes from choosing to live by principles and which almost always involves some form of sacrifice. But in a free market economy, it will come out on top simply because it is pragmatic. It works. It produces more for less. Eighth question. How does all of this apply in a bad economy, or let's say in a good economy, but a declining industry? My answer, it applies all the more, simply because the greatest resource is the creative capacity of people who come up with third alternative solutions in bad times. However, the natural tendency is for people to go back to the command and control transactional industrial model, which is not sustainable in the long run. In a short-run crisis situation, where the culture has a common purpose of survival, the authoritarian approach may turn the corner. As Eisenhower once put it, you don't speak democracy to the man in the foxhole. But eventually, you need deep involvement of everyone to make significant changes sustainable. This takes trusted moral authority leadership. Ninth question. How do the seven habits tie into the four roles of leadership? We've invested significant amounts of time and money in seven habits training. My answer, remember the seven habits are based on principles. The seven habits are character principles that shape who and what you are. The four roles are what you do to exert leadership influence in an organization. When you put the seven habits in the context of the four roles, they are the modeling role. That's the first leadership role, modeling. This makes the seven habits strategic. because they are modeling what you do while doing the other three roles: pathfinding, aligning, and empowering. The principles underlying the seven habits are like a deep well or an aquifer that feeds all other subsurface wells, such as TQM, team building, empowerment, innovation, etc. 10th question. Corporate scandals frequently make all business guilty by association. This brings into sharp focus the topic of character. How do you develop personal and cultural character? And how do you avoid these kinds of problems? My response: I had the opportunity of working on the aftermath of the Three Mile Island situation, the Rodney King riots, and the Exxon Valdez situation. And I basically found that all of these disasters were acute manifestations of a deep cultural phenomenon. They were the tip of the iceberg of people doing wrong things, closing up, shredding stuff, ignoring bad things, getting caught, and then having the media broadcast it. I think it's a valuable lesson for all organizations. Revisit what matters most to you, your vision and value system. Re-examine all of your procedures and practices, structures and systems, to see if they have institutionalized those visions and values. Feedback should reflect the honest judgment of advisors, suppliers, customers, and the entire value chain. You cannot talk yourself out of problems you have behaved your way into. You see, eventually, the hens will come home to roost. The law of the harvest always comes to pass. You will reap as you sow. Loyalty must not be a higher value than integrity. In fact, integrity is the essence of loyalty. You want your doctor to tell you the truth, even if you don't want to hear it. You want your doctor to be true to his or her profession as the highest form of being true to you. So also with your organization. See yourself as a professional whose highest loyalty is to moral and professional principles, not to your institution. That is the clearest way of being loyal to your institution. It's not about compliance. It's about the heart. The best way I know of to develop character in an organization is not to put it on some checklist where people judge others, but rather to hold people responsible for results, measured by a balanced scoreboard that requires a higher level of character development. This way, you're not judging someone's character. You're only giving them responsibility that requires character growth. 11th question. How do you maintain a positive, high-trust culture after downsizing? Answer. You know why cultures deteriorate after downsizing? Because principles are not followed, people are not involved, people are not informed, and people do not know when the next shoe is going to drop. Fear is everywhere. They don't understand the criteria for the decisions that are going to be made. They may not be economically literate about the industry, the economy, and the company. I have personally seen many organizations go through very, very difficult times requiring tough decisions, but manage in a remarkable principled way. Through transparent and open communication, through sincere and meaningful involvement and participation, through adhering to a set of fixed principle-based values, and by going the second mile, the people who were negatively affected and their families knew that the organization went the extra mile in their behalf, and goodwill in the community actually increased. 12th question. We often have leadership development academies, off-sites, special sessions, outside resource people come into the organization. They're very helpful, uplifting, and inspiring, but within a few days, it's business as usual. What do you recommend? My recommendation is this: to know and not to do is not to know. You can be temporarily inspired and emboldened with new and important knowledge and skills, but unless you apply them, you don't really know them. If the structures and the systems of the environment do not give you the incentive to apply them, you won't apply them, and you won't know them. Eventually, these kinds of experiences take a toll and breed cynicism throughout a culture. Change efforts and all these new management buzzwords will get to be like cotton candy, which tastes good for a second and then evaporates. The key is to take the material, teach it, discuss it, and try to institutionalize it by building the fundamental principles right into the daily processes of how the daily work gets done and how people get rewarded. Then it will take. No longer will it be a sideshow. It will be under the main tent. And sometimes when there is no external, structural, or cultural encouragement, you have to be a trim-tabber. 13th question. What if this approach simply doesn't work? My answer is, if people won't apply it, it won't work. There is no silver bullet. It takes deep commitment, patience, and persistence. Great courage, particularly in making changes or transitions from one mind and skill set to another mind and skill set. The associated tool set will help enormously, but in the last analysis, people must be committed to go to work. 14th question. What is the best way to initiate these changes, assuming you have made them inside yourself? My answer is, if you were driving a car with your foot on the brake, what would be the fastest way to move forward? To floor it or to release the brake? Obviously, to release the brake. Similarly, with cultures and organizations, there are driving forces and restraining forces. Driving forces are usually the logical economic realities, which would be equivalent to flooring it, pushing the gas pedal down. Restraining forces are usually cultural and emotional, and would represent the brake. Through third alternative and synergistic communication, restraining forces are converted into driving forces. Not only do you make significant advancements, but also they are culturally sustained because of this involvement and commitment. Kirk Lewin's force field theory is embodied in this answer. 15th question. Is all this material that new? I have heard these ideas from my youth. I see them everywhere in our history. My answer is, that's true. In fact, to further make your point, it's because of a principle-centered constitution and a free market that we see the unleashing of human potential inside the United States, where 4.5% of the world's population produces almost a third of the world's goods. The evidence of the power of these paradigms and principles drive dramatic results. Remember, principles are universal and timeless. They never change. The significant principles are probably best learned, or better, earned by farmers, simply because they are so close to nature and to natural laws or principles. They know you can't cram on a farm like people attempt to do in socially organized institutions such as schools. Competitive top-level athletics is another excellent metaphor because, again, there is no cramming. The price has to be paid to become a contender. So what is common sense is not common practice. That's why there is a need for renewal and recommitment and a restoration of the character ethic and a principle-centered leadership. 16th question. Is this material based on research? Answer. If you mean double-blind empirical studies, no. That is, with the exception of our scientific execution gap studies. There are so many interdependent variables at play. But if you mean historical analysis, literature review, and drawing upon extensive action research, absolutely yes. 17th question. What organizations are models of these kinds of ideas? You will find such models in every field of endeavor. They are all around you. Organizations like the A.B. Combe School and the USS Santa Fe submarine are all around you. The litmus test is this. How empowered is the workforce? How much do they focus on and execute the organization's highest priorities? In fact, one great question to ask yourself is, how do cultures respond when you throw them out of their standard operating procedure? It's the best way I know to test whether an organization is truly empowered. And if they are empowered, you know they're applying such principles as we have been discussing. And if they are empowered, you know it's because of the principles they are living by. Companies that were researched in Jim Collins' work, Good to Great, are empowered organizations with humble, fiercely determined leaders and high levels of empowerment. Empowerment, of course, is not the whole answer. Most of the top organizations have moved or are moving toward what we call a balanced scorecard. Aligning operations with strategy, with the market, requires great judgment. Many organizations that once were very successful have gone into decline, so it takes constant vigilance in attracting and developing the best people, building the leadership ethic into the cultural DNA, as well as a great deal of personal, visionary, institutional, and cultural moral authority to keep sustaining the road to greatness. 18th question. Is this basically religious material? My answer, principles definitely have a moral and spiritual foundation, but they are not unique to any particular religion. I have personally taught them all around the world in the context of different religions and have quoted their different scriptural texts. Principles are truly universal and timeless. You know, I used to be shocked, but I'm no longer shocked, to see what happens when you get people anywhere in the world at any level in an organization significantly involved in developing their value systems. When the spirit of genuine openness and synergy is present, and when the people are truly informed, all of the selected values become essentially the same. Different words are used, different practices reflecting those values come out. But the underlying sense always deals with the four dimensions spoken about throughout this material: the physical, economic, the relationship or the social, the mental or the talent development, and the spiritual, having to do with both meaning and integrity. If you want to have an interesting experience yourself, just study the mission statements of a few organizations that have produced those mission statements through involvement and identification over time. Different words will be used, but you will find that they are basically saying the same things, even though they may not be living them. 19th question. I am both discouraged and impatient. Is it ever too late for me to change? That's a great question. In fact, I find that the fundamental problem that people have in doubting the validity of these ideas is not the ideas at all. They make eminent sense to most everyone, but what they doubt is themselves. All I can say is, start slow and in small ways, make and keep promises to yourself. Let your conscience be your guide regarding what promises to make. Once you make them, however small, keep them. Little by little, your sense of honor will become greater than your moods. As you acquire an increasing sense of self-control, self-mastery, security, and competence, you will be able to make larger promises and keep them, and then to go into new fields, to leave your comfort zone and take more initiative. Remember again the story of the Chinese bamboo tree. There is a certain species of the Chinese bamboo tree that when you plant it, you see nothing for 4 years. Just a little shoot out of the ground and that's it. You weed, water, cultivate, nurture, and do everything you can to make it successful. But you see nothing. In the fifth year, this particular species of the Chinese bamboo tree grows up to 80 feet. You see, in its initial stages, all of the growth went underground into the roots. Then once it had its roots in place, all of the growth went above the ground and was visible, giving evidence to the earlier cynics that the growth had been going all along. That is why the personal level of character development always precedes trust building in interpersonal relationships, which precedes the creation of a culture in an organization that truly executes on its highest priorities. It is never too late. Life is a mission, not a career. The 20th question, how do you know this works? My answer, you only really know by working it. To know and not to do is really not to know, remember. Another confirming source of evidence will be getting the pragmatic results that come from those that are being served, clients, owners, employees, citizens, or customers. And with getting good information on the entire supply team and your own culture. In the last analysis, I put more faith in discernment through the conscience, combined with observation and measurement, than I do in observation and measurement without discernment. I find that most people intimately, which means into me see, know many things they should be doing and many things they should not be doing. If they will simply act on that knowledge, their other questions will be simply academic. Eventually, those questions will also be answered, not just from learning the answers, but particularly from earning the answers. The developmental process paradigm answers the how and when questions and teaches us to conquer ourselves first by subordinating what we want now for what we want later.
We hope you have enjoyed listening to this special unabridged audio program of The Eighth Habit, From Effectiveness to Greatness, and have gained new insights that will serve you and your organization. For more information on this program and other programs by Dr. Stephen R. Covey, please visit us online at theeighthhabit.com or stephenrcovey.com or call us at 1-888-868-1776 or 1-801-817-1776. We look forward to hearing from you.